I have a beautifully deep and far-ranging conversation with my guest, Reverend Bridge Feltus, this week. Another human I wish I could be around in my daily life, Reverend Bridge is so full of powerful wisdom and gentle kindness. It's really difficult to talk about other human beings, but from the beginning of our conversation to the end, I felt like we each had created a really gorgeous space for our interview. We talk fairy tales and villains, and the compassion we should have for the quote-unquote bad guys. Reverend Bridge talks about the great works she's done in her life, and how she's trying to heal other humans with her words and the classes she offers. She also tells the story of her dear friend Michael, which might hurt some of your hearts to hear. But it is essential to understanding not only the world we live in, the country we live in, but just who Reverend Bridge is and why she is doing some of the work that she does. She's joyful, she's unstoppable, and she is in this world to make a difference. There will be a link in the episode show notes so that you can discover a bit more about this wonderful and lovely human. But enough of me talking, so here we go. My interview with Reverend Bridge Feltus.
I decided to move to Germany. I have an uncle who, he's no longer with us, but he was stationed in Germany in the 60s and 70s, and he fell in love and he married a German woman, and they had three children together. And he ended up staying in Germany, and he became a famous fashion photographer. And so in my 20s, I was looking for a way to get out of Compton. I didn't have a lot of opportunities. This is in the late 80s, early 90s. There weren't a lot of opportunities for work and career and things like that. And I was feeling a bit lost. So my name is Bridget Feltus, and everyone calls me Bridge for short. And I am a minister of metaphysical science and metaphysical parapsychology. I'm also a theta healer, and I teach those concepts around metaphysics and theta healing is really basically changing your mind. It's changing the way you think, changing your beliefs. A lot of times we have beliefs and ways of thinking that don't necessarily serve us, and they're habituated. And so I help people learn how to clear those non-useful or harmful beliefs and replacing them with positive or useful beliefs, generative beliefs. And because of something that happened in my family in 2015, I'm now applying everything I know from those two areas to anti-oppressive work. So I'm working with people around their thinking and their beliefs about social oppressions, systemic oppression, relationships, all kinds of different forms of oppression, not just racism, but also ableism and gender and sexuality and religious persecution, all of the different areas in which we are in many ways oppressed across the board, everybody. So, yeah. I was born and raised in Compton, California, on a farm. That's something that's very unusual. There's a small part of Compton where it's zoned for farming. And so we had an acre-sized farm and raised animals and won all kinds of awards in the regional, you know, country fairs and things like that. So I grew, it's funny, I'm a farm girl in the city.
Well, I'm in love with you already. Let's just get that out of the way. Just have to put that out there, everybody. I wish you could see her face. If you go to my YouTube channel, when I post, you know, the little nugget of the miracle we'll be talking about, you all can see how radiant and just gorgeous she is. Wanted to say to you, it's very interesting, this idea, and I think it is so needed and so essential. And I'm grateful that you're working with people's stories, the stories that they take on, whether the stories are from a childhood incident or a family member later in life saying something, or even the greater society at large. We are all walking around with these stories inside us. And some of them are really gooey and sticky and icky. And so why would we ever want to approach those monsters, you know, because they can be, it can be really scary to unlock those doors. Yeah. I just interviewed this fabulous gentleman. I haven't produced his podcast yet. Have you heard of Louis Malmadrona? He's written multiple books. The first book I read was Coyote Healing. And he's a combination. I mean, he's indigenous, but also Hispanic. He's, as he said, he's a mutt as far as his lineage. He's an MD as well. So he went to Stanford, MD. But really, he has discovered that when you are healing someone or beginning that process, it is so essential to figure out what are the stories the person tells about themselves and the greater world, because you can heal the body. But if that heart sentiment of I'm not worthy or I don't deserve good things is still in there, it's going to drag the healing process along. I find that fascinating.
Absolutely. Even there's in your neurobiology, there is still, you know, we say we're healing the body, but some of it stays with you, even on the physical plane. So it's, you know, when we talk about psychology or mental health and ways of thinking, we really sort of imagine them as separate from your body, but they really aren't. This is why so many people are getting into somatic work these days, because mind and body overlap. And if you study the planes of existence through the lens of metaphysics, it's one of the first things you learn is that there are planes of existence and they overlap each other. They're not completely separate. They're actually in one. And we name them separately so that we can talk about each of them and their attributes separately, but they're not really separate. So you can heal, like you can have a wound and you can heal that wound and survive it. And there will still be neurological scarring, if you will, on your nervous system that you might think you're fine. And then one day something happens that triggers a response and then your body responds. You know, it's not just mental. So, yeah, most definitely one of the things that I found really moving about studying metaphysics is the idea that all of our feelings are valid. Doesn't matter whether we want to call them right or wrong. We have them for a reason. Cause and effect is always at play. And so we have to sort of let go a little bit of this idea that thoughts can be crimes, so that we can look at our ways of thinking and address how we express them, how we behave on the physical plane, motivated by those feelings. And sometimes a valid feeling isn't necessarily a valid action. Right. So great example of this in my Heal Thyself course, we talk about trauma, and we talk about how European people, or white people, we might say, come from cultures with fiefdoms and imperialism, and this made America, the idea of America, really seductive to try and get away from that classism and gender bias of European cultures. And in the process of trying to expel themselves or exodus themselves from that, there were some cheats. Slavery was a cheat. Racism is a cheat. And we're seeing right now, this is a very touchy subject, but we're seeing right now the same thing happening with Israel, where in an effort to heal from their own trauma, they're inflicting trauma on others. So it's making it very confusing because people are mixing up anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, and they're not it's not the same thing, right? So the idea of what has happened in the past is valid, but how it's being expressed and enacted on the physical plane right now is not okay, right? So this has happened, and it creates re-traumatization for white people. So all of these things where we typically talk about them as if we've got a villain and we've got a victim and we've got perhaps maybe a savior, right? But all three of those things, all three of those roles, we talk about them like they're separate, and they are not. You can be all three at once. You can be two at the same time. You can be none of those things. And depending on the situation, you could actually be any one of those roles. So if we remove that, then what are we left with? Cause and effect. This event, this action caused this damage. So intergenerational trauma and epigenetics are things that people don't really talk about much, but those things perpetuate behaviors in anyone who goes through any significant kind of trauma. So I'm addressing all of that. I'm also addressing the media and all of the ways that we're miseducated about history. One that came up today, so amazing. I made a post today about this study that found out that, I don't know if you know who Sojourner Truth is, but Sojourner Truth, she wrote this, well, she made this speech. And most people know this speech from the line, "Ain't I a woman?" And this was her way of saying she's a woman too. White feminist movements the suffragettes were speaking about women's rights, but they were making behind the scenes deals that would exclude Black women from those women's rights struggles. And so Sojourner Truth came forward and said, "I'm a woman too. Don't leave me out of this." And this speech, everybody knows it. It's very famous, but it's written, the translation of it was written in this very broken Southern, what some would call slave colloquialism. So very difficult to understand. And, you know, like, she didn't speak English properly, but come to find out, this was a translation made 12 years after her death by a white person, and she didn't speak like that. So another translation that was done weeks after she gave the speech from a recording shows exactly what she said, and it was nothing like that. There was no broken English. There was none of the this, that, there stuff was real. So it's just an example of how history told by the people in power is not necessarily true history. It's always going to serve the people in power. And guess who that harms? Everyone. Not just Black people. It harms everyone. Because it's miseducating.
Absolutely. And I think one of the biggest disservices, you know, the media, or if you want to just talk about narratives that are surrounding all of us all the times, or these stories that are kind of being put out into the world or served to us, you know, those stories are, for me, I'm going to just put this on me and say, they really encourage me not to dream greater, because I think to myself, what's the use? What's the hope?
Yeah.
And I really want to get back to what you said about you. I mean, you said so much, first of all, and I'm grateful for all of it. And it's fascinating and amazing. And I'm loving this conversation. But when we're talking about stories, you know, whether they're in the greater world or we tell them ourselves, are you familiar with The Hero's Journey or The Heroine's Journey by Joseph Campbell? Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people. I really just urge everybody to get familiar with what that journey looks like, because, you know, going inward and seeing what you need to heal or what you need to embrace or confront or engage with is a hero's journey, because you're going to go inside in your body and start wrestling with these stories that you have. And, you know, part of the hero's journey is, you know, there are helpmates, which are entities or beings that want to help you. And then there's the monsters. And one would think that the monsters are maybe those memories or those traumas you don't want to face. But if you think about, but also there's the hero's journey in the world with each of our lives and all of this stuff. And I think it's important to kind of, I'm not trying to romanticize or kind of suggest that confronting your own inner stories is this easy, fun hero's journey, heroine's journey. It's not. I mean, it's a struggle for a reason, because on the other side, hopefully there will be illumination and learning. But it does, it helps me, because I'm a reader. I'm someone who loves the written word. I love fantasy. I love science fiction. When I am starting a healing process, I always think to myself, okay, what little beings are going to help me, and what monsters am I going to have to face? And am I strong enough to face those monsters and kind of either vanquish them or befriend them and get them to come along with me on the adventure? I'm like, hey, follow me. I just think there's so much potential for us to rewrite our own stories if we're willing to go inward and engage with it.
It's very important. It's also very important for us to acknowledge or actually discover what's been done to us from the day we were born. It's very important, because there's so much unconscious programming that we're not aware of. You mentioned the hero's journey. There's a story arc that we're taught. From the first time we're read for fairy tales, you know, we're never told the story of the villain. We're never told why is this woman have this sort of deformed body and olive toned skin and big nose, and why is she living separate from the rest of the village, and what happened to her? Why is she so mean? And What is her vengeance about? What is she avenging? What is her, what happened to her? We're generally just, it's just treated like that's just who she is. Like there's no cause and effect story there, nothing. Just that's who she is. And she needs to be abolished or punished or exterminated. There's no concern for preventing that sort of character. So we just keep going through these cycles of, you know, villain, victim, savior, and we never talk about how do we get there. And it's okay. It's perfectly acceptable in our society to vanquish someone who we've decided is the villain. And it's so easy to make someone a villain. So I can remember many stories that I was told as a child. And I have some German family. So I have some German, half German, half African-American cousins. And I'm married to an Austrian man. He speaks German. And so I have some connection to German culture and Austrian culture. So I know their folk tales. And when my son was growing up, I, you know, read some of those books to him. And his German grandmother gave me this children's book that had this story about a Moorish boy who the German children were teasing him. And this story is supposed to be like very humane. The story is supposed to be teaching the lesson to not make fun of him. But the way that the message of it was like, he can't help that his skin is dark. Like this was a disability or something. Like it was a deformity or something. And in the end, the way that they taught this lesson was they dunked the German boys in a vat of ink to make them the same color.
Is that so a folk tale?
Yes. The story is called Struwwelpeter. And he also had like very natty, wild hair. And they talked about him as if he were ugly. But he can't help that he's ugly. He can't help that he looks like this. Don't tease, be kind to him because he can't help it. Well, there's nothing wrong with him. So why is that even a thing? Right. So there's all of this sort of sometimes even attempts at morals or, social etiquette that still has a tinge of ignorance in it about the intimacy of relating to people who don't look like us. And it's artificial. Like children don't have that when they're born. They don't care who they play with. Like they literally don't care. They don't care if you have an arm missing or if you're blind. They don't care. They will play with anyone. So this is, this is a thing that what it instills, in addition to white people having the conditioning of supremacy, it also creates a fear in white people. Because there's some part of your system that knows this isn't right. So you feel in some way handicapped yourself, or even a fear that someone would see you in that way. So a lot of what we call racism is people defending their position in a really messed up system that's based on lies. I'm doing this course. It's actually a series of courses that teaches. First, I tell my story. I tell the story of my cousin who Michael was 32 and he had three daughters. He had a 1-year-old, an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old. I want to say she was 8 at the time. And he was not together. There was two different mothers. Two of the children were with one mother and one with the other. And he wasn't together with them anymore, but they were friends. And at some point they had to get on welfare because Michael lost his job. He was laid off. This is in rural Missouri. And the company he worked for laid him off. And so he spent several months looking for work. And the women, the mothers of his children, applied for welfare, and they force them to name who the father is. And then what they do is they go after the father for that, for the money that they give the mothers to help with the children. And so for 3 months, he was not able to pay. And he found a job and he caught up. It was something like $8,000. He caught up with the money that he had to, that he owed. And they hadn't released him from this debt yet in their, in the system. And it went to a warrant. And he was dating a white woman whose ex-husband was a police officer. And again, this is very rural. It's in the boot heel of Missouri, small town, fields everywhere. My first time going there, it's like as far as you could see, vegetable fields. So there's very little true progressive thinking in these areas. So they started, the police started pulling him over once or twice a week and giving him tickets. And at some point, an officer pulled him over and they saw that he had this warrant and they took him in, they arrested him and he didn't have the money for bail. And he told them, he swore up and down, he paid, he doesn't owe this anymore, he's already paid it. They didn't care. He told them that he was a severe diabetic, he didn't have his insulin with him. They told him he was lying. They accused him of lying. They put him in the jail, and this was on a Friday. They couldn't arraign him until Monday. So he sat in this jail until Monday and died. He actually didn't make it to Monday. He died in the jail because they didn't get him his insulin medication and accused him of lying about needing it. His girlfriend came to the jail and brought his insulin, you know, they have the little packet thing, brought it for him. And they said they couldn't give him, give it to him. And there were medical professionals in the, on the premises. There was an emergency room directly across the street and they let him die. In fact, he was screaming at the top of his lungs, in agony and pain, so much that the other people who were in the jail started yelling and insisting that, demanding that somebody do something. And so they put him in a wheelchair and they took him to another cell and hosed him down with a water hose because they were accusing him of just trying to get out of jail, trying to get them to let him go. And that's how, that's what happened to him. Within a few hours later, he was dead. And they then took his body to the ER across the street and tried to get the ER to say that he died there. And they refused. So they took him to another hospital and tried to get them to do the same thing. This was crazy. So, you know, I have to say, like, prior to this happening, you know, I live a fairly comfortable life. I have achieved some privilege of my own through education. I've got some proximity privilege because I'm married to a white man. I live in a pretty decent neighborhood. I don't have a lot of stories to tell about any sort of, my parents were very protective of us. So I didn't have to deal with a lot of firsthand knowledge of racism. This changed everything for me. And talking about it publicly, because we were really trying to put pressure on the courts to do something about this, because they weren't going to do anything. They actually handed his sister a $400 check to go towards the burial. No apology, no accountability, nothing. So I went there for his funeral. And you wouldn't believe this. There are separate, there's a white a white cemetery and a black cemetery still in this town. It's bananas. And people were, we marched, we did the whole thing, and just having conversations with people. I have a pretty big following online. And when I started to tell this story, people accused me of not telling the whole story. There must be more to it. He must have done something wrong. He must have fought back. You know, there must have been something he did to deserve this. My husband had a cousin who was a member of the agent in the FBI, and he point blank told us that this couldn't possibly happen because they have rules and they have laws, and it's illegal that they would not give him his medication. But it actually, he's dead. So he stopped speaking to us. I mean, this has all been really bizarre. This happened in 2015, and it took probably, I want to say, about 6 years before they got their day in court because nobody wanted to deal with it. We had to get the most prominent civil rights and police brutality attorney in the country before that actually happened. And of course, these are the kind of things where you see, if you don't have money and you don't have connections, you'd never even hear the story. Nobody would even know. So this is happening all over the world. It's happening everywhere. And in America, a Black person is killed by police or vigilantes approximately every 28 hours. And I can't get away from that. Around the same time, my son was one night coming home from a party, and you know, he hung out with friends till about 2 a.m. And when he came home, there was no parking on our block on the street we live on. So we had to park around the corner. And as he was walking from his car, this woman, 2 a.m, she starts following him with her Rottweiler and interrogating him. Like, what are you doing here? Get out of here. And he said, I live around the corner. And she's like, prove it. Show me your ID. And she actually followed him all the way back home. And I was furious, of course, you know, I'm his mother. I'm like, I got in my car. He didn't even tell me. He didn't tell me because he was so upset and so traumatized by it. And he didn't want to upset me. So he didn't tell me for 24 hours almost. And then when he finally told me, I was beside myself. I got in my car and I'm driving around the neighborhood wishing I'm going to find this woman. Thankfully I didn't, but you know, I called the police and they said, there's nothing they can do about something like that unless something serious happened. So, you know, it's like, that's the sort of things that are happening in the world. And we can look at those people who should have been held accountable. By the way, nobody was fired in regards to my cousin's death. Nobody lost their job. The same people, by the way, did similar things. There have been probably 10 people who died in that jail over the course of a year. So I don't know how many since then, but within the year of my cousin dying, 10 other people. So, you know, this is, and the same people are still working there. Nobody got fired. So this is what's happening. And part of what I feel is really important around telling your story is that you're willing to actually understand that your impact in the world around you is a part of that story. And the world's impact on you is a part of that story. You will have more compassion for yourself if you can realize you're not, you know, like in a vacuum. Your thoughts, your beliefs, your fears, your concerns are there because of something that has either happened to you or something you've been taught or the way you were raised. And you're not, it's, you know what I mean? You're not just an occurrence that happened randomly. So those things are all a part of your story. And it's very important to understand that, where you come from, who your people are, even down to like, what languages did my great, great grandparents speak? It matters. It has an effect on how people communicate, you know? So understanding those things is important. That's why that story about Sojourner Truth really matters to me, because when you're a Black kid and you're being taught these things, you think, oh, these people talked this way because they were uneducated and they were poor and, you know, maybe not so smart. That was not the case at all. In fact, she didn't speak like that. She spoke Dutch. So it's really a trip to understand how much misinformation or disinformation we're given and how much violence there actually is that doesn't get called violence. Right? So even those fairy tales, I feel that a fairy tale that teaches morals that are not based on reality, this is violence. Disinformation, miseducation, this is violence. Because what does it create? It creates a world of people who are living based on lies, and they don't understand why things aren't working, why people are constantly getting hurt, why everybody's so afraid, why everybody's so violent, why everyone's so vengeful and paranoid, and why people do drugs and become alcoholics, like all of these things. You know, I work in an industry of healers, and everybody's peddling their methodologies, and you know, they're dealing with specific things like ADHD or neurodivergence or depression or whatever those things are. Well, they're there because of something. They are the effect of a cause. And most, I would say almost every area of human suffering can be traced back to oppression of some sort. So, you know, the fact that we're so quick to persecute anything that's unfamiliar, and when I say unfamiliar, really what I'm saying is that is outside the framework we've been taught. So this is why we have so much issues with people who are queer. It's why we have issues with people who are old, because death is unfamiliar and they're closer to that end of it, right? Some people have real issues around babies. You know, they're very, don't want to be around babies, don't want to hold the baby, don't want to understand the baby. They don't have the patience for the baby, you know, all of that, because it's unfamiliar. They don't know how to interact. So how do we fix that? I think intimacy, for one. Intimacy with ourselves, intimacy with each other, and creating this possibility of cultivating tolerance, and not just tolerance, but understanding and connection. And part of that is, you know, in the metaphysical work I do and the somatic work I do, it's understanding your emotions as sensation. Just like an itch is a sensation or pain is a sensation, that emotions are sensations. They're part of your nervous system. So understanding that, maybe you would think differently about your feelings. We call them feelings for a reason. They're feelings because you feel them. Just like you feel, you know, if you have a thorn in your finger, you feel that, right?
Ask you just a question, because my second question always is, but I think it would tie in really beautifully with, you know, I've looked at your website and you have the Remember Institute, And then I'm thinking about you growing up on this farm.
Yes.
And growing vegetables and, you know, taking care of sweet little animals. And I guess this might be a two-parter, but when you were a kid, did you envision or imagine or get a hint that you would be doing this work? And is it, my second question always is, did you grow up in a religious household? So I don't know if that affected, you know, kind of your journey to where you are now.
Completely. Of course it did. Yeah. So, first of all, we didn't just raise little sweet animals. We had 3,000-pound beef cattle. We had horses and we had all the whole thing. So yeah, I had the experience as a small person of learning to raise these animals, and they, you know, this is in the city, so that small amount of land means that they weren't like on a pasture somewhere. And if you're going to show them in competition at fairs, there's another element, the showmanship element, where you have to train them how to walk on a halter, and you have to learn the psychology of the judge that judges you in the show ring. You had to learn how to groom the animal in a way that showed off their musculature, and how to teach the animal how to stand with their posture so that their back's not sloped or they're not slumped. They're not, you know, looking around. All of that stuff we had to train those animals to do, which means training ourselves as well. So we did a lot of practicing. And this is something that people don't like anymore. This is like, as a teacher, it drives me nuts that people are so out of the relationship with practice that they just want things to happen immediately. They want the short version. They want to just take the information and think that having the information is enough to become an expert. It is not in anything. You have to practice. You have to have practical experience, and repetition is what gives you mastery in your mind. So yes, that was, and I hated it as a kid. I hated it. Oh my God. My father made us do the same things over and over and over and over again, while the other kids, you know, that we went to school with, we're out playing and, you know, roller skating, things like that. We were with our animals, walking them around the block, learning how to, you know, training them to stand in good posture and learning how to keep them calm, and also learning how to keep our eye on the judge. This is a really big one. I wrote a whole essay about this to find it and republish it. But there's this part of, there's in the fair competitions, there was the judgment of the anatomy of the animal, their meat quality, basically, if you will. So they want to see that you've fed the animal well and that its fat to muscle mass is, you know, they're going to come up and feel the animal's musculature. So there's that part of the competition. And then there's the showmanship competition, where they want to see if you've handled the animal and you've trained the animal and you know how to show an animal well, because that animal represents, if you were a rancher, that animal represents your whole herd, right? So you bring your best animal, right? So one of the things that my father taught us was to always be aware of the judge, no matter what you're doing. If the animal moves its foot out of place and you're trying to get the foot back in place, you still have to keep it out of the corner of your eye. Know what the judge is doing, because the judge doesn't speak. He hand gestures. And if they are gesturing you to do something, you have to do it immediately, or they hold that against you. You just missed your turn. So, and then the final placement, like first, second, third place, they just do like with their fingers, they point at you and then tell you to go to that spot. I know y'all can't see me, but I'm gesturing. They point at you, and then they point to the spot they want you to go to. And if you miss that, you're screwed. You missed your chance. And so he taught us to imagine that the judge had a $50 bill in his breast pocket. And that was our $50 bill. We want that $50 bill. Don't take your eye off that $50 bill. You're going to have to learn how to see what you're doing and what they're doing at the same time. And so it changes your awareness of your periphery, right? You have to pay attention to everything that's happening around you. And that is it's a huge, powerful mind exercise. It made me more empathic. So much to the annoyance of anybody who's close to me, I'm very empathic. I don't miss anything. And so that's a big deal. So that part. And then my mother, she was a musician and a choir director and very religious and, very much active in the music department at the churches that we went to when I was growing up. And, I can't even remember how many choirs I was in, but I remember being in choirs and having to learn harmony and learning how to blend in a choir setting. It's very different from singing solo. And those mental acrobatics and learning music theory, and also the principles and community culture of the church was really important as well. In sociology, they talk about places. So you have your first place is your home. These are areas of human activity. Your first space is your home. Your second space is your work. And then your third space is community space, where you interact with other people in your community. And the church in Black culture has always been that, the place where people come together. And as people move away from Christianity or they move away from organized religion, they've lost that community, that central place where people come together. And it's a huge problem. It's huge for all of us, actually, not just for Black people. It's a big problem. And I think it's why a lot of people still stick to the Christian church in particular, even when perhaps in many ways socially, those environments aren't necessarily always in integrity. But people stay and they're dependent and they're habituated to having that third space, and they don't have another alternative. So one of the things I wanted to do was pull the best of everything and use it in my work. I wanted to be a psychologist, and then I decided halfway through my studies, I don't like this. It's too industrialized. It's too, I just didn't like all the rules and you know, it's like a religion. It is. So I wanted to take the best of what I learned there and what I learned from my spiritual journey in the church and really learn some new things. Like, why does prayer work? What does this mind over matter thing? What does that abracadabra thing mean? So I did comparative religious studies. And then I did metaphysical studies, and I learned how to use my mind and my words and my actions for the greater good. And now that's what I teach people to do. And my most popular work right now is still the work around anti-oppression. And it's a touchy subject. It's really complicated to deal with because people are so... Oh, I have this course called Heal Thyself And it's actually called Heal Thyself, Transformative Initiation for People Racialized as White. And it's not a glamorous thing. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with the healing and New Age communities, but these people are very much like spiritual tourists. They want a quick fix. They want to go away for the weekend and do yoga and meditate and feel better for a couple of weeks and then go back to their same misery. Well, I'm actually not teaching in that way. I'm teaching more cognitive, sustainable, how to think, not what to think. So applying that to anti-racism work, anti-ableism work, anti-homophobic work, it's different. It's not as glamorous or seductive, maybe, as what people usually do. So I have to kind of find a way to make it inviting and get people to come in and do this work. And it's a challenge, because what has to happen is the denial has to be disrupted. That there's any choice, that we think there's any choice but to do this work is problematic. Everything you see in the news would be impacted by us doing this work. Every single problem, including war, including poverty, including the billionaire problem we have, all of this would be impacted by this work. Because at the core of it all is this lack of community, lack of empathy, and everything is like stained with fear. And people don't know how to deal with it. They don't know how to address it. They don't even know why it's that way. So that's what I'm doing. And, you know, there's movements around this stuff. I'm not the only person doing it, and I'm happy for that. But it is definitely challenging work. I have a lot of friends of all different races, and to talk to someone I love about their racism can be very complicated, because people don't want to be told they're racist. And the actual fact of the matter is, if you live in a white supremacist society and you're white, you have some kind of racist conditioning to work on. And that's not people think of racism as Hitler. That's what people think racism is, or the KKK. But there's subtler racism that actually supports those people, that makes it possible. If you think about, like, how did Hitler get away with all of that? Why did people follow him? Why did they support him? Why did they not fight back against him? We don't understand that. We need to understand it. We need to take responsibility instead of iconizing rulers and leaders, and make change. You know, we live in a so-called democracy. When I hear a Democrat speaking about what's happening in Israel and they're not doing anything to stop it, and they're funding it and defending what's happening, it's just not okay. And I feel responsible for that. That's my president. I'm responsible for that.
Thank you for all that. I had the incredible privilege, you know, I don't think I realized it until a few years ago, that I grew up overseas. So I grew up in Guyana in South America and then in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And so I always talk about, you know, my childhood. I went to school with kids from everywhere, all over the world. And you were 100% right on when you say the kids don't care. I mean, I didn't care what anybody looked like, what their religion was, what color their skin was. I was just like, do you want to play? Like, let's play soccer. Let's have fun. And
because you grew up in those environments, that's intimacy. That's intimacy. It makes a difference in how you think and your level of fear and your ability to connect and understand someone who's not like you. It totally makes a difference. And I bet while you were in it, this wasn't like something that was talked about. You didn't even have to talk about it, really. You're just in it. It is what it is. Oh, this is a person with a different religion than mine. This is a person who thinks about things a little different. Oh, they don't look like me. They speak a different language. It's just what it is. I lived in Europe for 5 years, and I found it really interesting that Americans, not just Americans, but also any English-speaking people from anywhere, would go to a non-English-speaking country and not even try and learn any of the language. It's bizarre to me. Like, I just don't understand it.
I do have to claim that I did walk the Camino, and I walked through France, and I can't wait to get back there. But I did, the most important phrase I learned was, I am lost. That's the thing that saved my bacon over and over again. And then, of course, but I didn't learn the language the way I should have. Thankfully, there always seemed to be someone.
How long were you there?
I started in southern France, and I took about two and a half months to walk up to northern France.
Okay.
I did walk a little bit along the Spanish coast. I never got to Santiago, but that wasn't really the purpose of my trip. That Camino thing is a whole other unbelievable, unreal story.
When you say walk, did you walk literally? Yeah.
Yes. I backpacked. Yes.
My mouth is agape. Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was, it's really truly is a whole other story of how that even happened. But I do think you're so right on with my childhood has changed my entire life. And I've said this before that my first great heartbreak was moving back from Pakistan and being plopped down in the middle of Illinois where everyone was white. I did not understand anything. I mean, it was like Jordache jeans, what you wore to school, what you brought in your lunchbox, all these things. My heart.
Totally different priorities.
Yes. And suddenly it was like, you couldn't be friends with everyone looked the same, but you couldn't be friends with everyone. I mean, there are all these cliques and things. It was just so heartbreaking for me. And so
and the parents.
Yeah.
Promoting that.
Yeah.
Like, stay away from that kid.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I actually had to be helped. I had to do fourth grade again, because I just could not adjust. It was so discordant for me. But yeah, that and growing up overseas, of course, has affected my entire life. And I tell people I'm endlessly trying to recreate the sandbox from my childhood. So I'm always like, I love meeting people. I'm like, come play with me. Come play in my sandbox. Let's have fun. Let's be friends. It's just this compulsion I have because I yearn for that space. I yearn for that kind of community and belonging and love and acceptance and conviviality. Yeah. So, so, so important. So thanks for speaking on that because we need way more of that, a lot more. So, the main question of the podcast is, I ask every single guest, I would love to hear a story or stories where you feel like you've witnessed something that was magical or something that was miraculous. It could have happened to you. You could have witnessed it. Anything that you'd like to share with my listeners.
Oh my goodness. Magical things are happening all the time to me. Well, let me just say this first. My definition of magic is anything that I don't yet understand the workings of. Something maybe that I could not have predicted or don't understand the workings of. I think that at some point, you know, the fact that we can sit here, I can look you in the face in real time and you can hear me speak. I don't know where you are on the planet. You could be thousands of miles away. And I can speak to you. 100 years ago, people would have called that sorcery. There's so many things that we're able to do. A recorded voice. Some people would have called that sorcery 1,000 years ago, right? So Magic is simply the things we don't yet understand. And the key word there is yet. And we are evolving constantly. So let's see, what magical thing happened to me that I could share? Oh my gosh, so many. Oh, how about a love story? How about a love story? That'll be good. So in my 20s, I decided to move to Germany. I have an uncle who, he's no longer with us, but he was stationed in Germany in the 60s and 70s. And he fell in love and he married a German woman and they had three children together. And he ended up staying in Germany and he became a famous fashion photographer. And so in my 20s, I was looking for a way to get out of Compton. I didn't have a lot of opportunities. This is in the late 80s, early 90s. There weren't a lot of opportunities for work and career and things like that. And I was feeling a bit lost. And so I decided to move to Germany and kind of hang out with my uncle and my cousins for a while and see what happens. Well, he said to me, "Don't come just yet. You need to have a plan. What do you want to do with yourself?" I'm like, "I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know." Well, he's like, well, you didn't finish school. What are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I'm in beauty school right now," because I thought that would be fun. And so I finished beauty school and he's like, "Yeah, but this is just one of those little Maranello beauty schools. They don't really teach you art and science and all that kind of stuff. It's just like how to pass the state exam. That's not good enough. What are you want? You're going to do it. You're going to really do it. You need to master it. So what are you going to do about that?" I was so devastated. I'm like, "I don't know what I'm going to do about that." So, so that night I prayed. I said to God, I said, "Please show me what to do. I do want to be a master of whatever it is that I decide to do with my life. So please, I'm asking you, show me the way." The next day I got a call from my mom. She said that the church that she was playing for, this is around the same time of the Rodney King riots. This is right after Rodney King happened. She said, "Vidal Sassoon is coming to our church on Sunday, and he's creating a scholarship for the Sassoon Academy, which is a 10-month program. It's like $15,000. And it's like the top of the line, the best school in the world you could go to for hair cutting and hair design and all of this," right? So I showed up and I applied for the thing. There were 3,000 people who applied and I was one of the 13 people they chose. And so I got my little scholarship. I didn't have a car. I was living in Compton still. And it's about an hour and a half bus ride to Santa Monica, where the school was. And first week of school was just like a nightmare because I didn't have the money for the equipment and I didn't have a car. And it was just really harsh, like 3 hours on a bus round trip. And I prayed again. I'm like, I need some solutions. I'm not going to make it. The school called me up and said that they were donating my tools the next day. And one of my family members said they had a car I could have. I hadn't even, by the way, told anyone that any of this was a problem. I was still pretty young and naive and didn't really have the, you know, I was still kind of embarrassed about not having everything in order. I didn't know to just say, "I need this." So people were coming out of the woodwork to help me. And a couple people, you know, donated some money so that I would have gas money and money for parking. And it just all kind of fell into place. Halfway through the program, Vidal Sassoon decided to offer me funding to start my own salon. And I ended up turning it down and moving to Germany. So I moved to Germany, joined an agency for makeup artists and hairstylists, and ended up having my work shown. I'm saying this is all happening within a 3-year period, having my work shown in, Italian Vogue, and I did work for Chanel and Gautier, and I mean, you just name it, all the famous photographers I worked with over there. And of course, with some help from my uncle, who was a fashion photographer. So he helped me out a little bit there. But he insisted before I came that I actually have a real and solid plan, all of which felt very much impossible. So this particular experience changed me in such a way that I am really annoying to people who say I can't to me. So the number of times people have said to me that I'm gaslighting them or that I'm not listening, I'm like, no, I'm actually listening. And I believe you when you say that. I believe that that's what you believe, but I'm telling you, you're mistaken. And you actually can do whatever you want. The thing is, do you want it? If you don't want it enough to do whatever it's going to take to get it, then you're right. You can't. So, you know, I know it's kind of cliche, but people say, you know, never say can't. And I never say can't. I'll either say I will not, or I'll say I don't know how, or anything, but I can't. Incapacity is not a word that I use. So when I'm dealing with people who are oppressed, this is a big deal. When I'm dealing with people who don't know they're oppressed and who typically we think of as the oppressor, that's a really big deal, because we all have that. That's what oppression does to you. It tells you you can't do this or that. And there's always a way. And it's interesting, during Black History Month, I'm sharing all of these stories about Black people who did all these amazing things. I'm like, oh my God, they created that? Like, everybody uses that. What? They invented that too? Oh my gosh. And the teachers that are helping me teach this course, they're historians and sociologists and psychologists and African studies specialists, and they teach 20,000 years of the history of Black people and the history of oppression. And you would not believe the things that Black people have invented that came out of Africa. And so, you know, I think about all of that in the context of white supremacy, in the context of slavery, in the context of my people's history. There's nothing I cannot do. How's that for a magical story?
I hope this conversation gave you as much happiness to listen to as it did for me, making it and meeting Reverend Bridge. And I hope that we all can come away from it a little bit wiser and more hopeful about the world. Please do check out our website. There is a link in the episode show notes. Be sure to dive into her Remember Institute, where the tagline is, "Heal yourself, heal the world." There's a 14-week intensive, and it's semi-self-paced. and really check out some of the responses of the people who have taken this course. It is truly changing lives. As well, there will be a link to our website, The Intersection for Mankind, that describes itself as a movement that educates and entertains with the intent to empower, enlighten, and inspire mankind through the collaboration of art, science, spirituality, and technology. I need to thank Reverend Bridge for being on the podcast and for sharing her gorgeous self. Thanks to everyone who listens, and please do consider leaving a review or giving me a rating wherever you find the podcast. And by the way, sharing is caring, so do share the podcast shamelessly with everyone you meet. This is like the only time I'm going to encourage shamelessness, so please take advantage of it. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Reverend Bridge and always have hope. Because hope is really a superpower. Hope can change the world. So use that superpower to motivate yourself, to keep yourself going, but also to teach others and to lift others up. So be like Reverend Bridge. Have a superpower called hope. And then go use it to change the world. That, wow, I was just sitting here thinking, I mean, my heart is buzzing. I'm feeling a heart love for you, but I want to go home with her and be in her pocket and be best friends. That's what I was thinking. I thought, I'm just gobsmacked and a little speechless, and just, you're just such a beloved, and by that I mean beloved, you know.
Well, thank human, you.
I can tell.
Well, just to give a disclaimer, I know some people are going to be like, she's full of it. There are things that I haven't figured out how to do yet. Plenty of them. Plenty. I would like to have a ranch that I can open up as a retreat center. And I haven't figured out how to do that yet. But I'm not telling myself I can't.
Okay.
I don't have like one, only thing I have is my vision. None of the rest of what needs to be in place have I gotten in place yet. But I know it's possible and I have to figure it out. So that's the part that people maybe don't have the patience for, or the self-confidence. Listen, confidence and trust are something that you have to choose. It's not the point. The whole point of them is that you may not have the evidence in front of you. And in order to find the thing, you have to actually believe it's there somewhere. It could be right in front of you. So many times it was right in front of me. Literally, that story that I just told happened within 2 days of me thinking, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but I know that I want to do it and I have the will to do it. And so I'm going to do it. And I really literally did not know how it was going to happen. That also soon dropped out of the sky. I had a conversation with him. Rest in peace, by the way. I had a conversation with him a couple of weeks later. And he talked about his parents and the Holocaust and how he decided to do this scholarship to help Black people in the Black community to have their own businesses. Because part of what was happening during that Rodney King thing was that there were people who had businesses, mom and pop shops or whatever, in the community who were not from the community. And they were clashing. The Korean people, for example, were clashing with the Black people in that community. And one of the things that Black people were saying is, we really resent that we're not given the support we need to start businesses. You know, we work hard, our kids go to school and they get good grades. Some of them go off to college and they come back and they can't uplift their own community. They've got to move somewhere else to have a good life. They've got to pretend to be disconnected from their blackness. They got to be more white. You know, so he really wanted to open doors for people who otherwise wouldn't have had that opportunity. That is magical. Magic is not something that Disney creates. Magic is real. And it's mental plane overlap into the physical plane. The will becomes the action. And we all have it. We all have it.